Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglin from the Annex Gallery of the Eastern Columbia Building in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles, and I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Phil Lernes, for your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Thanks, Dean Haglund. I am looking past your artwork.
Yes.
That is
hanging now.
Hung by the chimney with care. And I am looking across the street at the Orpheum Theater, where a huge line is forming for EA Sports Game Changers 2011.
That's right. This week, of course, it's E3 at the LA Convention Center, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, where every game ever made is rolled out in giant 100-foot screens, and you can go and play. And, of course, you got to have tickets. So they're all over here as Entertainment Arts, or Electronic Arts, I mean, pulls out their preview of their upcoming 2000 forever games, I guess. You know, if I played more games, I'd be really excited about what they had there.
It's all happening downtown, though.
It's all happening downtown.
We're recording two shows here today. On Thursday, there's a fantastic gallery opening going on right where we're sitting.
That's right.
It's the official opening.
Not the soft opening we had last month, but the official opening of my show.
Now, if it's a soft opening, is there such a thing as a hard opening or
yes,
not?
Yes, this would be the hard opening. This Thursday, June 9th, starting at about 5 or 6 p.m., right at 845 South Broadway. If you find yourself in the Los Angeles area, please come on down, see the art. It's all free, and then you can experience what Art Walk is in downtown Los Angeles. A giant street party of 50,000 people.
Art Walk, Dean Haglund style. Many people love it because you can pretty much just get drunk for free.
Used to get drunk for free. Well, no,
you really can. They all serve wine. Yeah. Your gallery served wine.
Yeah, they serve on this side. More down Fifth and Main, they stopped serving wine.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Now, tell me, down the street here is the glorious relic, we'll call it, of the Tower Theater.
The Tower Theater, yes, a spectacular theater.
On the marquee there for several weeks has been advertised something called Roaring Twenties Purim Party.
Yes. I believe that was you could rent that theater for private use for filming a number of TV shows have been filmed in there. What's great about it is they removed all the seats, so there's a proscenium stage and then a giant cement floor. And I believe they actually had somebody rented for a Purim party in a 1920s style. I didn't know they did that.
I love that it's still up on the marquee.
Well, they're not going to change the marquee until someone else pays to have a new marquee.
No, we're not going to put any effort in.
No effort whatsoever.
And that's love that none of the letters have been stolen. Remember how in the old days you couldn't have a marquee like that without letters being stolen or rearranged.
Or rearranged to say something hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the way Bob Pliskin rearranged the letters in our names, using all of them to create, of course, You Are Lead Handgun and I Am Hell Inspires. That uses all the letters in the names Dean Haglund and Phil Lernes.
That's fantastic.
He, as a kid, we know what he would do when he saw theater marquees.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You mix that
up. A lot of fun.
Hilarious.
You know, I have no excuse this week, of course, unless we run out of time.
Of course.
I have no excuse of leaving any topic behind on the notes for today's shows.
Fantastic.
For two reasons.
One,
you didn't like that I said we're recording two shows today, but I think it's all right if people know that this is the last time we're going to be together for a month.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, Wednesday we're going to record another show.
All right.
But, yeah, I'm going to faraway exotic locales, and we'll talk about that in a little while. So we really should hit everything that we have to talk about today.
Please do.
We have, you know, very exciting shows planned and already some cases recorded in the interim. The other reason I have no excuse to leave any topic behind on my notes is that I can actually read my notes.
Yay! That's right, ladies and gentlemen.
As I wrote about on Facebook, you know, at age 32, 11 a.m. in the morning meant it was time for Hair of the Dog.
Ah.
At age 42, it meant it was time for an appointment at LensCrafters.
There you go.
Dr. Willa Wong. And can it really be Dr. Wong when it felt so right?
Oh.
Dr. Willa Wong, a very dear friend of mine.
I didn't
actually
realize that. Oh, yeah. You have friends in the...
is a phenomenal eye doctor.
Uh-huh. And, optometrist.
I had actually turned other people onto her work without ever having experienced it myself.
And finally.
Because I really take my own sweet time when I know I need something, like better see the periodontist.
Right.
Put that on the to-do list.
Uh-huh.
And then after a couple years of my to-do list crossing its eyes at me and frowning, then I get around to doing it. And so finally went into the eye doctor, and I decided, you know, I approached it with gratitude and the kind of the gracefulness with which I am entering this chapter we will call middle age. And and I have to say that coming out of it with my, really, let's face it, fashionable and dashing Dolce and Gabbana frames.
Oh, my God.
I nevertheless experienced profound sadness. And it was the sadness of realizing how bad actually I had allowed my eyesight to become.
Right, that how blurry.
How much strain I'd been putting my eyes through these last couple years.
Probably giving yourself migraines that you didn't even realize.
Possibly.
Yeah,
possibly.
See what I'm saying? Yeah. That's what I'm telling you.
And, you know, one of the responses to migraines is that I do need to shut down my eyes because too much light is getting in, sensitivity to light.
Absolutely.
And
what
of
better
course,
way than glasses? Do they change in the sunlight? Do
they don't. And these are I'm what they call farsighted.
Right.
I can see far away very, very well. It's really things that are up close that I have menus in restaurants.
You can't see, can't read it all.
Always was holding the candle up and trying to push it away. So anyway, so it's exciting.
I'll have what she's having.
It's
That's great. Well, I guess this explains those intense stares that all your recent photos had with our Chilpack Hollywood promo that everybody said you look completely insane with your eyes bugged out of your head. So I guess
no, it's actually what's interesting is that my eyes now are bigger. My eyes never bugged out of my head because I always had a glinty stare.
Yes,
I had kind of
glinty.
A squint because exactly that. Now my eyes are bigger because now I can actually see, whereas I used to really narrow my eyes to try to narrow my focus.
Oh, is that what you're doing?
Yeah,
that's a fallacy to actually narrow your focus.
I was always surprised over the last couple of years in photos how narrow my eyes would be.
Right. But there were some of them, they were quite large. I'm saying some of those.
Well, that's just to compensate.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Man, look at all the tour buses coming.
A lot of traffic.
A lot of traffic
now,
for this EA game changer.
You know, it's a big week for you and art.
Art.
The art gallery opening.
Yep.
And, of course, we were at the studio of a very dear friend of ours and a wonderful artist, Lee J. McCloskey.
Lee J. McCloskey.
In Malibu. At the Olindar Foundation on Saturday, where we had a screening of The Truth Is Out There, which really became two screenings because of the unprecedented turnout.
Was that, yeah, it was a lot of people there.
We did not really do much in the way of pushing this screening, did we? Because it's a free screening. Well, it wasn't free. It was a $10 admission. But it was to benefit the Olindar Foundation.
Right.
Lee McCloskey is one of the experts, so one of the interview subjects in The Truth Is Out There. We collectively, as we've talked about before, refer to all those interview subjects as the Friends of Truth.
Yes.
And it is our aim, our intent, though it will no doubt take a couple years to pull this off, to have an event or a screening for each of those Friends of Truth as a way of thanking them.
Yes.
And so... we had it at the Olindar Foundation for Emerging Renaissance, which Lee founded, and he and his wife run. And so it was a $10 suggested donation to support the foundation.
Fantastic.
And a huge turnout. Ended up needing to set up a second screening
upstairs.
Area.
Yeah. That was a surprise.
And it was kind of fun because the start times were staggered as a result.
Yep.
And so it was kind of cool because we would hear a burst of laughter from one area, and then a few minutes later, a burst of laughter from the same part. It was
just like,
cool.
Hey, everybody's getting it.
Everybody's getting it.
Everybody's getting the
joke.
That
was a good screening. We missed a lot of that.
What happened there?
So really a lovely turnout and a lovely discussion afterwards. And One of the things that comes up now as people see this film, especially people who don't know us, right, and they or even people that do, you know, and they you know, gratefully they love the movie and think it's a great film, and I've been getting this a lot lately of, you know, you could really attract a big distributor with
yeah,
this film,
right?
And we've had, you know, distributors kind of call up and sniff around from various parts of the country, and it's kind of funny the reaction that, you know, because we lead with the fact that we're self-distributing this
right
film.
This is our business.
And they know this. And then these people come up and said, well, you know, you could easily attract a distributor. Distributors are interested in this. You could, you know,
right,
as if that would then mean, oh, okay, we won't self-distribute.
Yeah, exactly. That self-distribute is like your second, is your B plan.
Yeah, right? Like that, we jumped ahead to the B plan without right, trying the
without,
A plan.
No,
right, this is, you know, really, as we talked about on the way home, this is our chance to see what we can do.
You know, this is the, I think you said something to me that was quite clear, and I don't know if enough indie filmmakers know this, is that you create a project, and then if you sell it to the distributor, you are back at square one, that you have to then create a project again, because that distributor will either go and sell the film or
not.
Or not, as often as the case is.
And even, and then the third path that we all love, they sell the film and people see it and neither you nor your investors see any money from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you're back at even a worse square one in that you're in debt and then you have to, you know,
or you've got to find a whole new group of investors and say to them, well, here's what went wrong, and you've got to push the whole boulder up the hill again.
Yeah, I know. And whereas if you self-distribute, make money, get your money back to the investors, and make a profit, then everybody will be interested not only in the movie, but how did you make a profit with the movie? Because this moment you say you make dollar one, everybody's fascinated that
right,
you made dollar one in a movie.
Or and you know, we are going to make mistakes, of course, because
yes,
this is our first film that we're self-distributing, and you have to learn from the mistakes. It's better to learn from your own mistakes and be able to then adjust and correct on the same project, on future projects, than to be learning from other people's mistakes.
Well, and that's the thing. I think you also said that people go into distribution when they've failed at every other aspect of filmmaking.
Those
right,
who can do and those who can't distribute.
Exactly.
Was that the old phrase?
That's the old phrase, that they still want to be in the film business, but every other aspect has gone sort of south for them.
And so this was something that was whispered to a friend of ours there that night, which was, don't they realize that they could have this film in theaters?
Right.
And she said to the person, well, that's what they're doing. Right? It's just not going to be the kind of thing in theaters with the marketing blitz behind it where you see the newspaper ads and this sort
right,
of thing.
And you got one weekend to see it.
But we are going to do the kind of communal experience. We are going to set this up. And it's just funny because, you know, this phrase was always taught to us when, you know, back in the 80s when I was going to film school or early 90s, I don't remember when it was. But, you know, we always had this discussion, you don't want to make films just for your friends.
Right.
That was the thing, right?
That was
don't make films just for your friends. And I think that we, because of that phrase, we lost sight of something that's kind of important. Which is, wouldn't it be nice if everyone who went to our films was our friends?
Right.
Not that we're making our films for our group of friends, but that we make something, we go out into the world with it, and we invite people as friends.
Right, to develop that community.
Because
that community crowds around
after
it,
all,
right,
as we've talked about before, it takes a lot of courage to seek out any alternative work, any independent work in any field.
Yeah.
Right? All of us are so busy. All of us have limitations of time, of money. It's a lot more comfortable to go see the thing that everyone else is seeing, if only because you'll have something to talk about.
Right, the next day.
When everyone else is talking about it. It's very lonely to go be the only one at a play. You know, that's why L.A. has historically been a tough theater town, because you don't get that communal experience afterwards of going to clubs and bars and cafes
right,
and being able to discuss the latest plays with people.
Right.
Because odds are anyone you meet in those circumstances here in L.A., which is so spread out, are not, even if they go to see plays, they're not going to have seen the same
ones. The same one, right.
And so it does take a lot of courage. It does take a real adventurous spirit. And I, for one, have always felt that, you know, those people need to be rewarded, which is why we want to do things like discussions afterwards and Q&As. But I've always admired stage performers, therefore, who maybe even give more of themselves when the audience is smaller.
Right.
Because they recognize, hey, I'm not going to punish the crowd that is here for all those empty seats.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm going to reward because these people somehow managed to come. They sought this out.
Yeah, yeah.
And they deserve to be rewarded. And I feel like if you can have that attitude as the performer, as the storyteller, as the filmmakers, the distributors, then you're inviting people as friends. You're creating a friendship. And
that's the thing. You know, I was going to go see Mel Gibson's The Beaver.
Right.
Believe it or not.
Sure.
And for the very same reason that nobody's seeing this thing on limited release, right? It's like sinking to the bottom so fast because Mel Gibson's not doing. And yet it got a 10-minute standing ovation in Cannes. And it sounds like it's a great movie.
Or at least, if nothing else, a very interesting movie.
A very interesting movie. Like something you would never see a mainstream Hollywood do. And it's like, well, that should be rewarded. And I want to go and find that thing. And there's no theaters in Hollywood showing it. There's one theater out in Covina that's showing it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm thinking I'm going to get on the bus and go the hell out there and find this movie.
It's interesting that you mentioned that movie, because when I was writing down notes about this idea of self-distribution and, you know, making films for our friends. And,
right.
You know, I wrote down that Participant Films just turned 7 years of age. And Participant is the distributor.
Oh,
of
the Beaver.
And they've lost a lot of money on it. They spent $20 million making it.
Ouch.
And their biggest hit to date is Charlie Wilson's War, which had big name stars and quote unquote only made $65 million.
Right.
And, you know, it's founded by, I guess, the eBay guys, Participant Films,
right,
who made all their money through eBay, and they are making films that involve issues of social relevance. With the Beaver, it's how do we treat depression?
Right.
And the owner was very straight about this. In 7 years, and they released Inconvenient Truth.
Yeah.
Another documentary that made real, that was an Oscar-winning documentary, and it's slipping my mind at present. But so they've made good films.
Uh-huh.
They've made, if we can call a film important, they've made important films. They've distributed these. But no, they are not making money at this point. And the owner seems absolutely fine with this.
Right.
That he has put hundreds of millions of dollars into it. And as he says, I'm going to put hundreds of millions more into this. And he's using this model for a television platform, for a video on demand platform. He's creating brand, as we've talked about before.
Right.
And the participant brand is meaningful, even if it hasn't yet turned money.
Right.
And he's smart enough to use technology like he did with eBay to be able, he believes, to create a multi-layered platform that at some point will return the
money.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing.
And he's absolutely fine because he's making so much money on something else,
right,
that he does not feel allows him to participate in community.
Ah.
It's a business venture.
Right.
He seeks community, and he puts his own money into creating community, and that's why the name Participant.
I see.
And to a degree, that is what we're doing, right?
Right.
I mean, sometimes we're putting our own money into it. Most of the time, what we're putting in is really our own time.
Right, exactly.
And without a guarantee that we're going to make money off the time that we're putting into it. We believe we will.
Yes.
What we're risking is our time. And and it's a risk worth taking because, of course, the payoffs to it are far more than just money. The payoffs to it are, like we've said before, we'll be able to show people what worked, even what didn't work.
And what didn't work. You can have that as also your same business model.
We'll be able to have more interesting, more forthright, more illuminating conversations with investors.
Yeah.
Also with other filmmakers.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, we are building our own infrastructure on the next film for contacting people about the movie and setting these things up. Because it's been very interesting how now, only for a few weeks, we're actually feeling buzz growing about the film.
It's rather bizarre, isn't it? It takes a life on of its own.
Ticket sales, like you said when we came in. I mean, we made tickets for this screening in Washington, D.C. I guess we should mention at this point.
Let's do that.
There's a free screening at the College of Charleston in Charleston, South Carolina. I said free screening.
You heard that right.
At 7 p.m. On Thursday, June 23rd.
Okay.
It is going to be fun. I'm getting a lot of reactions from independent film clubs in the area, from Haunted Chucktown. I love the Charleston's called Chucktown.
Hey, Chucktown.
Haunted Chucktown, Haunted Charleston, different groups, because Charleston, of course, has this wonderful history.
Huge.
And is just so interesting. And, of course, a nice reaction at the college, although the college is on summer term.
Right.
So smaller amount of
crowd, but still.
Students. But I'm getting such wonderful feedback from people who didn't even know about the film in advance.
Right.
And so I could not be looking forward to this more. And again, why? I'm going to be making really interesting friends at this
Absolutely. You connect to the community.
And then, you know, and then on Wednesday, June 29th, there is a screening. This one is not free. We are selling tickets rather briskly at this point. They went on sale at like 4 o'clock this morning, and they're already going briskly. Anyway, and that's in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, again at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, June 29th. You can find a link to those tickets on our website, truth-is-out-there.com, and, of course, facebook.com/truthmovie is a great place to go. Send your friends to it to become likers. We are rigorous about contacting people directly about any screenings in their area, and of course we post updates. So you'll find information at facebook.com/truthmovie for both of these screenings and for the forthcoming very soon the LA premieres, two dates at the Downtown Independent in the third week of July, and we'll make those dates and tickets available at a more appropriate time.
At a more appropriate show. Yes, absolutely.
And the final last word about Truth is out there on our website, truth-is-out-there.com. There is a mailing list. You can, if you're not on Facebook, I encourage people to join the mailing list. Again, we will never give those email addresses away to anyone else, and we will only contact you specifically about how you, as an individual, can see the film in your area.
Exactly.
So that's it.
That's exciting.
And, you know, this idea of making films for our friends and thinking, you know, the whole wisdom of that, right? This came from a time before things like social networking, before you could literally have thousands of friends.
Right. So don't make your – now that you can have thousands of friends, why not make your film for thousands of people?
Yes, exactly. This was the thing. When someone said this to me recently, well, you know, the problem with self-distribution is I don't want to make films just for my friends. And I said, well, I can understand your point because I doubt you have many friends.
A zinger! Bang!
Because truly, isn't that it?
Yeah.
Isn't that it?
That's true.
Why don't we switch that around? I would like all the people who come to my films to be my friends. Right. I consider them. And that wouldn't change if I had millions of people see the film.
Right.
I would like them to know that if they come up to me, they will be greeted as a friend.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming to the show, you'll say.
And that's what we mean, you know, to a degree when we say, Dean Haglund, Phil Lernis, your friends in podcasting.
That's right. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Because just as we engage in conversation every week, we are engaging in conversation with our listeners every week. And they are our friends in the same way that I at least that I define friends.
Yeah.
And one of the most important definitions is, you know, your friends are people who will elevate the conversation, hold your feet to the fire, will raise the bar for themselves and for you.
Yes.
While at the same time, friends are the first ones to have your back and to let you know not to listen to those voices out in the world that tell you that you are less than, that tell you you are not capable of something, that tell you you are not worthy of love and respect.
That's right.
You know, it's that wonderful combination of raising the bar for you, of holding your feet to the fire, And because so often we are the ones, by the way, that tell ourselves we are not worthy, exactly. that we are not capable, that we are not these things. And at the same time, really do have your back in that way.
Well, now, are you referring to someone specifically when you say this? Has someone actually pulled their feet to the fire?
If I look back at the more than 4 years now that we have been doing this
more
show,
than 4 years.
We've had fantastic feedback. We have had people take us to task.
They have.
About things that they did not appreciate us saying.
Yes.
And sometimes, you know, they really held a mirror up for us. And we realized, wow, we did not say this the way that we did not convey the meaning we wished to convey.
Yes.
And
that happens in a show that's unscripted, by the way.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. So it's really fun. And this then again is the other thing about self-distribution or taking this in any art form, right? Getting to have that interaction, cutting out the middleman, cutting out the marketing departments, cutting out these middlemen, allows us to grow as artists and, oh, by the way, as people.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you get to have this mirrored for you by other people as opposed to being mirrored for you by numbers on a sheet.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's what the test audience said. Here's what the box office returns were.
We know
here's
this algorithm.
Here's what the Rotten Tomatoes percentage
exactly.
is.
And so we know, therefore, that we can sell this many based on these numbers, based on historical. This is what
or
always
how,
gets me.
How your work is being received.
Yes. So much of this marketing is on historical perspective, and that's what always floors me.
Numerical and historic.
Yeah. And so it's just like, well, you know what? The times have changed, and you can't depend on historical numbers to accurately predict future outcomes. And I think that is going to be where our business model in the future holds its head up high.
This is an amazing segue because
I think you just explained as
good as anyone I've heard, because this is a discussion I've been having for the last week,
mm-hmm.
about the, I'm going to call it failure, but certainly it's now the death of state film credits and state film incentives around the country.
Oh,
so many
died?
States... went the route of New Mexico, went the route of Louisiana,
Massachusetts,
Michigan,
Illinois.
So many of these, and Washington State.
Yep.
Giving, for those people who don't know, states will give some form often of tax credits or tax rebates to reimburse you for a certain percentage, and it always varied from state to state, of your budget.
Right.
Or your budget spent in state. It varied. Again, it varied because these states were competing to try to get the film business.
Right.
All of them now, as I gather, are dead or dying, except for Louisiana.
Yeah.
Where it's really made a difference and where it continues. Louisiana has as an enormous amount of production and a growing amount of production.
Right. Shreveport itself has become sort of the...
New Orleans.
Yeah, and New Orleans.
And California instituted, this was the second year of state tax credits.
Yeah, which they didn't think they needed because this was Hollywood. Everybody wants to film in Hollywood.
But so much runaway production.
Right.
They've now got a lottery system.
Oh.
And this was the second year, and this in 2010, they received more than twice as many applications for film and TV tax credits. And California Film Commission has awarded its annual $100 million in tax subsidies allocated by a lottery to combat runaway production.
A blind lottery.
There were 27 winners, down from 32 of last year, because the awards were slightly larger.
I see.
And there were 176 applications compared to 70 last year.
Okay.
So what is kind of clever about it is that in order to apply, you have to stay.
Right. Right. Oh, so you can't just go,
you
got the money.
You can't do it in advance, and then if you get it, stay.
Right.
No, you have to stay and produce here, and you might have a chance of getting a tax credit. A TV series, Justified, that you know I love, I've talked about on the show, it was one of the recipients.
Oh, look at that.
But anyway, so this is really one of the last two that I know of. I mean, so many of these are ending and really kind of failed to provide boosts to the state economies,
right,
the way that they thought that it would. And I feel that the phrase that you just said that I will never be able to repeat.
But we can rerun the show if we
want
to.
But it's because they were basing, hey, we got to do a tax, state tax credit. Look at what it's doing. Look at, here's the numbers on what it's doing in another state.
Right. So let's apply that to our state.
To our state, and yet that was just raw data. And, you know, it's like the concept, any economic concept, you know, like trickle-down economics.
Yeah, right. That failed miserably. It didn't trickle down to anyone.
Depending on who
you
talk to. It trickled down to the top 1%.
Right.
Huzzah.
It came from the half percent down to the 1%. Good for them.
So it's a really interesting thing, but I do, I as a student of film history, such as you are, and being here in... In downtown Los Angeles, and I was having this conversation this weekend about, you know, combating runaway production in Pasadena, of all places, which, of course, as you know, was a major city long before Los Angeles was.
Yeah, that's right.
And the first freeway on the West Coast was between Los Angeles and Pasadena.
Right.
And
now the worst freeway in North America.
And Pasadena really was great for film production because... In the early days of film production here, it could double for so many areas in the Midwest and the East Coast.
Right. You had the mountains. You had the small town. You had what big city
Victorian homes. You had mansions.
Yes, exactly.
Of the millionaires.
That's right. All of that.
What's so interesting, though, is this idea that it's such a shame that, you know, Hollywood productions are going elsewhere to get made. And yet... The historic irony of it is delicious, because that is Hollywood.
It was a runaway production.
Hollywood was created as a runaway production.
From New Jersey, where Edison had the patent for the camera, and he would take his goons that would go to other film sets and beat up anybody who didn't have a license for the camera that he had invented. So he was coming down on them, and they all grabbed their cameras, got on the train, and headed west, thinking they're going to run away from
It was a week-long train ride.
A week-long train ride. They got as far away as possible.
And so even when it became a little more civilized, let's say, you still, all the banks and the bankers were in New York.
Yeah.
You were, if you were the people running the productions, running the studios, you were a week-long train ride from the people holding the purse strings.
Yeah.
You were a lot more freedom.
You had a lot more freedom
to run the business you wanted to.
And basically, anybody coming out to try stop your production, you had somehow advanced word because there was phones,
right?
So you could just pull up stakes and get the hell out of there.
It's like, why would you ever want to make a movie, even an independent film, in the city where you've raised your investment money?
Right. You don't. You want to get out.
And you got to get as far away from them as possible.
And so what I had heard, too, is that they were going to get off at Flagstaff, Arizona. That was their plan, because Arizona had some sort of cowboy law, laws, but it was raining in Flagstaff. So they stayed on the train, and the next stop the next morning was Hollywood, California. And that's how Hollywood...
And now that all the entertainment production entities are run by MBAs and lawyers and bankers,
right?
Lo and behold, the production is elsewhere. Now, I understand that it's elsewhere for financial reasons.
Yes.
At the same time, though, it's still Hollywood.
It's still ironic that it's Hollywood. And it's, yeah. The irony is delicious. Works on so many levels.
Now, the one thing that I'm kind of grateful about with the collapse of so many film incentives is hopefully the conversation will die out about the, hey, can you do it here and here and here for money purposes?
How many?
Because rare is a show like Breaking Bad that is originally set in one place. It was set in Riverside, as Vince Gilligan told us.
Right.
And then the production company said, can you make it in New Mexico because of the tax credits? And he said, well, yeah, am I allowed to actually set it there? And so he rewrote it to set it there.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, Vince Gilligan's a brilliant writer and producer, and he really invested the story. I mean, like he said when he talked to us, he can't imagine now, having done the show in Riverside, because where it's set in New Mexico has become such an important character.
Absolutely.
In the film. Most times when we see films and television shows that are shot in one area, they're set someplace else.
Vancouver's a perfect example of that.
And it's such a missed opportunity because, again, films and television shows are, it's just another added layer to them. If you can get a real feel of the locale, of the place, and the time.
Absolutely. You know, there's a friend of mine who wants to actually film a show in Los Angeles, but he wants it to be a double for Vancouver.
Right.
Right? So it's like this whole other level of, like, how do we make Los Angeles look like other cities? Because that's hard to do with the sun shining all 24 hours a day and the palm trees everywhere. Everything's been shot, and it has a iconography all unto itself.
You need to remind me off air to tell you my idea of location for a script that you wrote.
Right. Hey, this is one of our rare production meetings that we won't have on
and
air.
It's foreshadowing because it is a film that gets mentioned in a show a few weeks hence.
Ooh.
And let's admit that we pre-recorded it.
Ow.
Because I think we can let everyone know now that it is without a doubt the funniest show we've ever
it's
done.
It's hilarious.
It is really... because we have you know, a supremely talented and incredibly funny guest on that show. So,
so
that will be one of the special treats we have planned for you during Phil Lernis's East Coast Adventures.
Right, and I'll be painting my darn little fool head off to get shows ready for the next 6 months.
I love, though, to, you know, with this conversation about the tax credits and the film incentives dying, and I read one headline, which is that the conversation is now changing.
Yep.
The question is now changing from does it help get the movie made to what best serves the story?
Ah, imagine that.
Imagine that.
And who would ever think that?
I mean, I love that, and you'd be surprised, right? I think people who don't make movies might be surprised at how often filmmakers and aspiring filmmakers think first, how can I get this made, instead of what's the best way to make it.
Right. Yeah, those are two different questions.
They really are.
I know.
And if you lead with the question of how can I, rather than what's the best way, boy, that's setting a dangerous tone from the very beginning.
Right, because then all you're going to do is make any compromise you can, because your goal is how can I, getting it made, as opposed to what is the best way.
Of course, inflexibility stands in the way of so much creativity, and sometimes the best stuff does come when your top choice proves unavailable.
Right.
And then you have to think quickly and you have to think creatively.
To do that.
Sometimes even better things come about.
Hello, Jaws.
But I would argue that it's because you placed the question of how can we best do this first.
Right.
As opposed to how can we.
Exactly. Right. I mean, I think about the shark failing in Jaws, right? That mechanical shark. And that made the movie so much better because it was like this unseen threat that was coming, you know, that
Absolutely.
Spielberg was brilliant in building that tension so that when you finally saw the crappy shark at the end a couple of times, it was, you know, you had already had so much payoff.
Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Leonard Nimoy was not sure he wanted to come back and do Spock again. He was dissatisfied, as were many people, with Star Trek the Motion Picture. And how they got him back was, how would you like to have a great death scene?
Ah.
And that was taking place at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, that's
And then it leaked out. And, of course, there was so much legal action about it leaking out and all of this sort of stuff. And in retrospect, all the filmmakers say, how lucky are we that it leaked out? Because... you know, it would have been, they were planning it, spoiler alert, like Psycho. They were planning it to be something like that.
That middle.
And instead now, of course, it is the climax.
And the emotional, one of the best emotional gripping scenes.
Of course, and they were so grateful for it. And not only that, but then they got to play on the rumors by actually killing him twice in the film. So it was really quite... Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert again.
If you haven't seen Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Wow. Just like I screwed up.
And by the way, he comes back to life.
Oh, way to go.
For 20 more movies.
And Gus kicks a field goal in the third act.
Oh, that was a callback to our Live at the Retro Dome show.
It certainly was. My best spoiler ever.
You know, we talk a lot on this show about the changing distribution models and methodologies in television and in film, and I found it very interesting that there was a public question and answer session with Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix,
uh-huh.
and he was talking about Netflix's foray into original programming.
Yeah,
because they're doing this House of Cards with Kevin
yeah.
Spacey,
right?
And he made it very clear that they are not particularly open to original programming on Netflix.
Wow,
that they would prefer to write big checks for HBO and Showtime, for streaming rights, rather than create their own for streaming.
Wow.
But that is not, they are a delivery. They are not, and this is what you and I cautioned, because people said, oh my God, this is going to be huge. Netflix is into original programming now. This is going to be huge. It's going to change everything.
Yeah.
And we pointed out, you know, they've done this before. It was called Red Envelope, and it failed.
Yeah, they hated it. Yeah, and it failed quickly, too. I mean, they didn't – it seemed like they made
– they shuttered that fast.
Like five indies and then realized what an uphill push it is to do this and then just sort of said, screw that.
So it was really interesting to hear him say that they would rather write huge checks. Like they're trying to re-up their Stars – you know, with the Stars Network, their
yeah.
streaming rights for Stars movie library – originally it was a $50 million, and right now they've offered, I think, $300 million. Stars is asking for $350 million.
Whoa.
So they're writing big checks, and they would rather do this.
And it makes
The one sad thing about this for a lot of people was that he shot down rumors that had been starting to bubble, because he is known to be a very big fan of Firefly.
And he
shut down the idea that they would be. He said, look, this is just not feasible. The actors have aged. The sets are destroyed. There will not be any more Firefly.
Yeah. Yeah, so. Just watch it in reruns. Ovation's been showing it, and now Sci-Fi will be showing Firefly reruns.
All 13 episodes.
All 13 episodes. You get to see him over.
What do
and
you
over.
Do after that day?
Rent Serenity at that point.
Yeah. Now, a show, though, that did get canceled that was originally rumored that it might be picked up by Netflix. I don't know where that got, you know, where that idea came from. I just think it's wishful thinking that people
yeah.
thought, oh, Netflix will be the place where stuff gets revived. But is the NBC series from this year The Event that I was watching?
Oh, yeah. What'd you think of that?
I really liked it at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's as we've said, you know, everybody wants to recapture the X-Files kind of mythology.
Yeah.
And I don't think they appreciate that at its worst, the X-Files mythology became the tail that wagged the dog.
Right.
That was never
the initial plan.
And it was allowed to develop over time.
Right. You had 2 years even before anybody realized.
Again, now, hey, wouldn't it be great if we recapture the excitement over the X-Files mythology? Well, now you've got to work out the mythology in advance. You've got to hit the ground running with it.
Right.
And then if it works, then you say, okay, now how can we stretch this out?
Right, a la Heroes. And then you're stuck in 16th century feudal Japan for an entire season.
And
yeah, never
which
mind.
Had nothing to do with the show. I don't know why I had to be in feudal Japan watching that show.
I know. I had a very bad cable package.
It was so distracting.
I don't know why I did that discount cable. That was stupid.
So I kind of enjoyed it anyway, and it has a cult following. And anyway, I guess Sci-Fi is negotiating
to make it
a second season and original series on Sci-Fi.
Well, that's good for them. They've done a couple of original series that I'm thinking did all right.
Battlestar Galactica.
They also
do a lot of really kind of crappy and awful jokey series.
Sharktopus? Mm. Oh, no, that's not those. I'm sorry. That flying shark that bought. Was that Sharktopus? I can't remember.
I don't know.
Mega Shark.
Now, here's the exciting thing to me.
Exciting.
Is that you actually saw a movie, I heard.
The rumors are true. I finally had an evening where I could go see Bridesmaids.
And I talked about Bridesmaids a bit.
Yes.
More in terms of lumping it in with Hangover Part 2, which I finally saw, and also the Woody Allen, and just, you know, the idea that there were three comedies in the top 10,
all
doing very well.
Yep.
And, you know, and that's always exciting because we just don't have that many comedies anymore. What was your feelings about Bridesmaids?
Well, see, here's the thing of
people have asked us, by the way, what we thought of
Oh, really?
Bridesmaids. Yeah,
okay.
So.
There's two things. One, that the hype destroyed. Everybody go, oh my God, so funny. What a delight this movie is. And then when you see it, you go, well, it's all right. It was fun. And there were some very funny parts to it. But as I...
This is with Hangover Part 2, you know, I walked out going, I didn't think the first one
was that
amazing thing that everybody else seemed to. So consequently, I didn't think the second one was the awful thing that most people seem to think it is.
Right.
You know, because again, it, as we say so often, it's expectations.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. And it's also in context of what else is out there. And if you look at when Hangover came out, all the other movies out at that time were either dramas or big action things. There was no other comedy to compete with. Here, Hangover is coming out at the same time as Bridesmaids, or Hangover 2, I mean. Bridesmaids.
Although it is a huge, I mean, it's the biggest hit of the summer.
Yeah.
And it's, and it is a big action piece also.
Is it a big action piece? Yeah. A lot of action?
Now, I found refreshing, of course, that so many talented
women,
female performers were able to really have an opportunity to strut their stuff and sink their teeth into meaty roles.
And be hilarious.
Yes.
Yes, that was delightful. But as somebody pointed out, the hand of Judd Apatow with the vomiting and all the other things that it's
a cheat to say cheat. that it's great that women get this opportunity.
Yeah.
They get this opportunity to be like the man boys.
Exactly. To do Hangover sort of thing, but in verse, right? And so you're like, oh. Because invariably, it's a story of friendship breaking apart. But added is all these Hangover-esque comedy moments that may or may not be...
The other cheat that I found very distasteful about Bridesmaids is, and I won't spoil.
Spoiler
anything here,
alert!
What troubled me is, if you're going to have a film should embody the theme that it's expressing.
Right.
And if your theme is about the importance of loving oneself, then you can't throw that over for, well, unless he's the right guy.
Right.
You know, because ultimately the movie's about finding the right guy.
Yeah.
There's no escape. They cheat on that. And
that's true. That's a bit sad.
It's sad. It is sad.
And I don't know if that's an executive rewrite where it's just like, hey, man, we need a love interest and this has got to pay off.
It smells like that,
doesn't it? It seems like it's shoehorned in because in the end, to me, my mind, it would have been just as satisfying if that character wasn't there at all. I mean...
you had an interesting, observation about... I don't know whether this led to the film being dissatisfying or not, but but about seeing the stand-up.
Oh, yeah.
The stand-up comedy
bits.
In the...
if you go to enough open mics in this town, you'll start seeing the same themes and the same kind of jokes in a orbit, in a life. And so the aspect of all of these comedy bits in Bridesmaids were basically... the milieu of all female stand-up comics right now in Los Angeles. And so it seemed like a compendium of all open mics that are going on, which is kind of interesting. I mean, I'm thinking that the screenplay I'm going to write, I'm just going to go see a bunch of comics all doing open mics and sort of gather and do a general wash of all their bits and string it together in a story, and I think I'll have in the next hit comedy.
With Hangover 2, you know, here's the basic tenor of the complaints about it, and it's the joke, right? My favorite old joke. But I enjoyed The Hangover Part 2 much more the first time I saw it when it was called The Hangover. Because it is an out-and-out remake.
Yes.
And
it has
I have advocated many times on this show, don't criticize something for what it's not.
Right.
Criticize it for what it is.
Right.
And... what it is incredibly lazy. The first 15 minutes, a lot of big laughs as they set up the new setup.
Right.
To get you to the same movie they did the first time.
Of course.
And then it's just lazy. And it's amazing how with one switch in the story, they could have breathed life into it.
Wow.
A character goes missing. Not a character from the first film. A new character goes missing.
Right.
And... if it had not been that character, but that character's father, then the story would have made sense. The story would have resonated. There would have been higher stakes.
Wow.
It would have, and it's just laziness.
You know what? This is always my favorite thing to do when criticizing. I often write film reviews for comedyfilmnerds.com, and this is always what I do when I criticize, is like, what would be the fix? How would the, what would be more compelling?
Well, of course, yeah.
And so when I hear that sort of thing, that makes me actually want to go see it, and then in my mind, develop the same storyline in parallel as I'm watching it.
Yes, and because, then, you know, this is, people will always say to me, people who've never gone to the movies with me,
right,
but they'll always say, oh, well, you watch movies differently than the rest of us, you know? And I keep being, I keep pointing out, I go to every movie wanting the experience I had, you know, when I was young.
Right.
Really being able to open myself to the experience.
I've seen
and
Gus.
Becoming, well, no, Gus, as you know, I watched The Projectionist.
Because
I didn't really give a rat's ass about movies. I was amazed by the magic of the
projection machine.
The projection.
Right.
But the Magic Lantern show. But I want the experience of Star Trek II.
Yes.
Of being able to believe in this world in the 23rd century and having no sense of time passing.
Right.
And, you know, I look for that. Every time I go to the movies now, it's just that it comes so rarely.
Yeah.
Increasingly rarely.
Yeah.
That very quickly I start to... I now ask myself the question, okay, where did it go wrong? What choice was made that led us here? And how might I have made a different choice?
Right.
Because then I have a good experience no matter what the film is because I'm learning something.
Exactly.
In the
that
process.
It becomes a teaching tool as opposed to an entertainment tool.
It's like, I've probably said this on the show before, but I'm the worst person to invite to your, you know, one's live performances, like plays and this, because if I have a great experience, I want to savor the experience. I don't want to talk about it afterwards
right.
with the person who's just
right, because they're going to wreck it. They're going to say, what'd you think of it? Or
they're in a space of, really, they've just come down off of this. They're just making conversation.
Yeah.
They're not really going to be receiving or thinking about it. They're just being polite.
Yeah.
And I want to hold on to it and really savor it and let it resonate and really start to go, okay, why did this affect me so much? And what about this? And then later have the exchange of ideas.
Yeah.
And if I didn't enjoy it, I can't lie. I still don't want the experience of asking myself the questions.
Right.
So either way, I've now learned to just go up and say, hey, thank you for inviting me. We will talk soon about this.
Right. And off you go. And that's and probably the best thing. Though some people take that as an insult, but you never know.
I saw something that I thought you were going to see a long time ago. Thor in 3D.
I've been trying to get to Thor forever. How did you enjoy your 3D experience?
Well... A Marvel comic book movie made by Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah.
Now, Kenneth Branagh, I was reminded watching the first 15 minutes when I felt so bad for so many actors who were taking this thing so seriously.
Uh-huh.
And I was reminded of what a cheesy quality there is in all of Kenneth Branagh's work as an actor.
Yeah.
And in his directing, too. Yep. There is a cheesy element to so much of what he does.
What was that thing with the scissors? Remember that after his second film?
Was that his modern film noir?
Yeah.
His attempt at a film noir. There was no movie cheesier than that.
That was so god-awful.
There's just this winky cheesiness about it. And anyway, it is so rampant at the beginning actually, there's a teaser on Earth with Natalie Portman and Stellan Skarsgård that begins the movie in a fantastic fashion. And thank God.
Right.
Because then the next 10 minutes are like, oh, dear Lord, this is horrible. I'm at a terrible Renaissance fair and in 3D. And anyway, thank goodness, though, that these actors do take it seriously. Because this is that rare movie that finds its footing gradually as it goes along and gets better as it goes.
Huh.
So whereas a movie like Iron Man 2 left many people somewhat underwhelmed because, in honesty, it's two-thirds a very good movie.
Yeah, right.
They did many things very, very well, but the ending was disappointing.
Right.
The climax was underwhelming. And that leaves you with this feeling of underwhelm as you leave the theater. Mm-hmm. Whereas Thor got better as it went along, so it actually left you with this sense of potential and promise for future installments for the Avengers and for this.
Which is it's the opposite of what I think my theory is of LA writers, that they always just pitch the first two acts.
Right.
And they don't even bother writing the third act until it sells, and then they don't have a third act because they're so busy always creating act one and act two to pitch in the room that they don't develop the story fully till it's, you know.
What's interesting to me is that I, as I'm watching this movie, I'm thinking, you know, why does this remind me of Babylon 5? And then sure enough, it turns out the story was written by J. Michael Straczynski, who created Babylon 5. So it was very interesting that he didn't write the screenplay, he wrote the original story, and his fingerprints are on this.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, that makes me want to
Chris
see it now.
Chris Hemsworth, who plays Thor,
is
absolutely a movie star. I mean, this
what?
Is like
holy
Chris Pine in Star Trek. He is
You're
a movie
kidding.
Star.
Awesome.
And
is he Thor-like?
Sure, I think so. I don't know the character so much,
right.
But he's a movie star. And Natalie Portman.
Aha.
Thank goodness for Natalie Portman.
Really?
In this movie. Because I will say this. This is the movie where she learned how to, or shows that she's learned how to act in a big budget blockbuster. How can someone so gifted, Black Swan,
right,
be so bad in blockbusters like the Star Wars trilogy?
Yes.
Now, maybe that's a bad example because many good actors can be bad in his
yeah, film. but she's also gone the other way. I mean,
but she really, in this movie at least, demonstrates, and maybe this is because of the hand of Kenneth Branagh, she demonstrates how to have the confidence to do less.
Right.
To do little. To
right.
to not
to, know
to not push too hard mm-hmm. against the incredibly artificial construct of most big budget
right.
blockbuster movies.
And the idea of inviting the camera in instead of projecting outwards.
So it's really quite satisfying in that way.
Well, I'm going to go.
Anyway, and the final thing that I saw, and this becomes an interesting distinction that maybe we'll talk about in months to come, and as
Can't
we
wait.
Get to our top 10 list, because it's a film that is my front runner for number one film of the year, and
what
maybe
the
number one film of the decade.
Wow.
It's the new film from Terrence Malick.
Ooh.
It's The Tree of Life.
Really?
It may not be Terrence Malick's best film.
Uh-huh.
It may not be the best film of the year. I have a hard time believing that it will be anything other than the greatest film of the year. Though.
What?
And it's interesting that when one says statements like this, people will say, well, what's the difference? And I get this a lot now when I will say one word and someone will say another word and I'll say, well, that's not the same thing. And they'll say, well, what's the difference? And I am always amused by that because we have different words for things because they do have different meanings.
So
and
it's not the best.
Let's reclaim the specific meaning of words.
Okay.
And so
here
something may not be the best, and it's still the greatest.
Ah.
I once read that as a comment about Citizen Kane. You might disagree that it's the best film ever made. It's hard to argue that it's anything other than the greatest film ever made.
Wow. Okay,
and
so
that's on the table. And maybe a month from now, when we reconvene, we can talk about what that might mean.
Okay.
Why was Muhammad Ali called the greatest? That was his nickname. The greatest.
But
he may not, pound for pound, have been the best fighter. He may not have even been the best boxer.
Right.
He had losses. He doesn't have the best record. He is, without a doubt, the greatest fighter. And why would that be?
And why is that, you know, is it to strive to be the greatest or is it strive to be the best?
I would say with the case of Tree of Life, that
it's strived to be
its ambition is virtually unequaled in cinematic history.
Wow.
And this idea also, getting back to the Robert Browning line from Andrea del Sarto, a man's reach should exceed his grasp.
Absolutely.
That's the measure of not only an artist, but a man. and to exceed grasp, and to recognize that failure is part of greatness.
Aha! So there is failure in this
movie. Always think that it's very interesting that Robert Browning used the specific word man rather than human or persons.
Right.
Because I feel like women do understand this, that failure is part of process.
Yeah, right.
It isn't something for judgment. And so often men get into the, I failed.
And
as it, well, are you done?
Yeah, exactly. You only fail when you stop.
And,
isn't that right?
So that this element of failure is a part of any story of greatness.
Right.
And here is a film that sometimes fails in it to achieve its ambitions. I don't think any film ever could, because its ambitions know no bounds. To truly show man's place
in the universe,
in the entire story of creation from beginning to end, through the tale of the death of a boy.
Wow.
And it's breathtaking poetry. It's heart-wrenching drama. It is science fiction.
What?
That brought not only gasps of astonishment to me, but in moments of just quick images, had me crying. Because
wow.
I could not believe the beauty that I was seeing. I could not believe that in this day and age of commerce and of
oversaturation of everything,
And the corporatization of everything, that, oh my God, we can still, through cinema, create these moments of beauty
wow.
that will resonate as long as people are watching visual
stuff. Now watch, I go and I'm going to hate it. Wouldn't that be hilarious? Now there's too much pressure on that
hilarious.
Thing.
Hilarious. No, but that's the thing. And, yeah. you know, expectation.
Yeah.
When the ambition is so large, I think expectation is small in comparison.
Ah, fantastic. Well, looking forward to that. And speaking of grasping beyond our reach, we've come to the end of another Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
We will be gone for, I will be gone for 4 weeks, but we will
be
here every week with a brand new show, which you can find at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. Download, stream them. Subscribe via iTunes.
Please do.
Become a liker of the show on
Facebook.
Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood.
Yep.
Write us ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com.
Follow us on Twitter. I'm Dee Haglin.
I'm Phil Lernis.
Until next week.
And of course, we have one other show that you will never be able to find in any of those places.
Oh, that's right.
It's a bonus anniversary show for our fourth anniversary that I have created. Everyone who's written us asking for it, thank you very much. I will be getting that out this week. And if you want it, 99 cents is all it's going to cost you. Write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, and I will send it along. Until July, Mr. Dean Haglund, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. Have a great trip.